Well, as I said, I have not spent a great deal of time discussing the resurrection and the life, the subsequent life that Jesus lived. I think it's important that we understand the resurrection, mostly because I think it is the underpinning for everything that we believe. The Apostle Paul did say in 1 Corinthians, if Jesus is not raised from the dead, then our preaching is vain, our hope is vain, and we are of all men most miserable. I don't think that Paul questioned the resurrection, but he is pointing out how important that resurrection is for all of us. So as we think about the resurrection, we're going to start by just simply looking at a lot of biblical information. I'm going to be running through some lists tonight, and you can, of course, access those lists if you go back and look at the taped material that will be available on the website. Or if you'd like to have one of these lists, then just let me know and I'll print off the discussion that we're doing tonight and you'll have these lists. Now, I don't give you the lists because we're going to read every passage on the list, but I think seeing all of these things helps to reinforce how central the notion of resurrection is throughout the Bible. Resurrection is developed much more clearly in the New Testament than it is in the Old. But the Old Testament contains frequent references or suggestions to a life beyond death, compared to the references that are in the New Testament. The Old Testament references are certainly not as clear, and there aren't nearly as many of them in the Old Testament as there are in the New. And that makes sense because the New Testament comes after Jesus is raised, and that's a fact upon which the apostles can hang a lot of what they had to say. Now, next week, we're going to look at some of the Old Testament references. That's where we'll start. But I just wanted you to understand that the resurrection and subsequent life, the life that happens after the resurrection, is central to everything the New Testament says. So let's just think about how many times the New Testament writers referred to the resurrection. You just can't escape the resurrection of Jesus in the Gospels. Every one of the Gospel writers talks about how Jesus was raised from the dead. Acts records sermons and events that don't make any sense unless Jesus has been raised from the dead. Now, sometimes the sermons in the book of Acts explicitly refer to the resurrection of Jesus. Sometimes what happens can't be understood unless the resurrection is real. So you have Jesus' appearance after his death. That's in the first chapter of the book of Acts. Remember that he appears to the disciples, then he ascends back to heaven. And as infrequently as I've talked about the resurrection, less frequently have I talked about the ascension. So we're going to spend some time doing that after we finish talking about the resurrection. Peter, of course, preaches the first gospel sermon, and it focuses on the resurrection, Acts 2, verses 24 through 26. And then in chapter 10, at verse 40, when he's at the household of Cornelius, he makes use of the resurrection. Peter and John, or perhaps Peter and all of the apostles, make several statements that are recorded for us, and they're statements that are attributed to Peter and John or Peter and the apostles. Most of the time, if you're reading the King James translation, the impression that you have is that Peter was kind of the spokesman. That may or may not be true, but they're attributed to Peter and the apostles, or Peter and John. And you see those kinds of statements in chapter 3 and chapter 4. Then you have Stephen's vision. He sees Jesus in heaven. And it's important to realize that he can't be there unless he's been raised from the dead and has ascended to heaven. Because had he not been raised from the dead, had he not ascended, he would still be in hell. He would be in that place of disembodied spirits, waiting for a time when everything would be released. Paul's conversion events, chapter 9, chapter 22, chapter 26, it's retold three times. Every time it's told, Paul sees the resurrected Jesus. He preaches a lot of sermons, and the most famous one is probably Acts, the 17th chapter in Athens, when he's standing on Mars Hill, and he preaches about Jesus as opposed to the gods that they were worshiping. And then he makes his defenses for everything that he's been preaching. He does it in the 23rd, 24th, 26th chapters. And in every case, the core of his defense is, I am preaching the resurrected Jesus. Look at Paul's letters. 1 Thessalonians, 2 Thessalonians, Philippians, Colossians, Ephesians, Galatians, Ephesians, Colossians, 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, Romans, 1 and 2 Corinthians. Look at the letters that were written by other New Testament writers. Hebrews, we had some question about whether Paul wrote Hebrews. James, 1 Peter, 2 Peter, 1 John, Jude, Revelation. In fact, there are only, by my count, 4 New Testament books that don't contain any kind of reference to the resurrected Jesus. Now that, in a sense, that's kind of like the book of Esther. A lot of people question whether Esther should be Esther should be a part of the Old Testament canon, because the name of Jehovah never appears in the book of Esther. So some people suggested, well, maybe Esther isn't really a canonical book, but you can't explain Esther without Jehovah. So it's certainly there. It's just not explicitly mentioned in the book of Esther. And in the same way, the resurrected Jesus is certainly there in Titus, Philemon, and these two epistles that John wrote. It's just not explicitly mentioned. So I don't doubt that these books were written so that they could be included in the canon. It seems to be no question to me. So as we talk about the resurrection, and specifically the resurrection of Jesus, that's where we're going to focus most of our attention. As we talk about the resurrection, there are 5 themes that I think are consistently presented. And I think these are 5 themes that are important for us to understand. And we'll develop these a lot more carefully as we go through our discussion of the resurrection. The first theme is that the resurrection of Jesus was a bodily reality. Jesus' body was raised. It wasn't as if the body was spirited away and the apostles claimed that he had been raised. Jesus' body was raised. Now let that sink in for a minute. It's important because it informs the second theme. The second theme is Jesus was resurrected first. He's the first fruit. We will follow. We will be raised as well. And the way that we're going to be raised is like the way that Jesus was raised. Our resurrection is as much a bodily reality as was Jesus' resurrection. We are looking forward to that. Jesus is the first fruits. There's no question. We're not Jesus. We don't take his place. We don't diminish his resurrection. Our resurrection will be like his. And that's important. Third theme, judgment is connected with the return of Jesus and our resurrection. Jesus is in heaven. He is there until he returns here. And it's at that time that we are raised. Fourth theme. Jesus' resurrection establishes his lordship and his divinity. You know, when Bob was reading this morning about the things that Jesus said to his apostles after he had been raised, remember the statement he makes? Matthew 28, all power is given to me in heaven and on earth. Go ye therefore and teach all nations. That was a statement that Jesus made after he was raised from the dead. Now, that doesn't mean that somehow Jesus didn't have all power before he was raised from the dead. He did. In fact, he had all power from the very beginning of time. He was there at creation. Without him, the things that we see weren't made. Okay, but Jesus, after his resurrection, said to his disciples, and it's a statement that he never makes until his resurrection, all power is given to me in heaven and on earth. The resurrection of Jesus cemented the idea of his power. It cemented the idea that he was God. And then the last theme is the resurrected life, resurrection and the subsequent life. The resurrected life that Jesus experienced is often used as a metaphor for our conversion life. We get to walk in newness of life like Jesus did in some ways. It's a metaphor. Don't press that too hard. It just understand that it's a metaphor. So let's go back. Let's talk about these things individually. Resurrection's a bodily reality. It's not just a pipe dream. It's not just a fable. It's a bodily reality. Jesus was resurrected in a physical bodily form. He could be touched. Thomas reached out his finger, put it into the nail hole in Jesus' hand, probably down here. He could act on the physical world. He could interact with the physical world just in the same way that he did prior to his death. So he was resurrected in a physical bodily form. Now, his resurrected body was different than his pre-death body. So he has a bodily form that's different than what it was before. And the Apostle Paul kind of explains some of this in 1 Corinthians 15. He says the corn, when you plant it, has a physical body. Then it's in the ground. It then sprouts and it has a physical body. It's still corn. But this corn is not like that corn. Well, wheat is the same way. The germ, the seed cannot germinate unless it's placed in the ground, and then it produces another body. So the pre-death Jesus is intimately connected with the post-resurrected Jesus. A bodily form. Jesus' resurrection was a singular event. It was, in many respects, separate from the resurrection of other people. Now, other people in the Old Testament period were brought back to life, right? We've already read that. The prophet could bring people back to life. Jesus himself brought Lazarus back to life. Jesus' resurrection was a singular event. Now, it was, I can see at least two ways that it was distinct from any other resurrection. First, Jesus did it by himself. He laid down his life, and of his own power, he took it up again. Everybody else that had been raised from the dead was raised through an agent. Okay? Jesus had the power to lay down his life and take it up again. And it was by himself. Then there's a second way that it's different. Remember when Lazarus was raised from the dead? He came out of the grave. He was still wrapped in the linen cloth that they had used to prepare his body for burial. Why do you suppose he brought the linen cloth with him when he was raised? Now, this is a supposition. It doesn't say that this is why he did. Yeah, he was going to need him again. Lazarus died again. He died. He was raised. But he was going to die again. What happened when Jesus is raised from the dead? Anybody remember? Yeah. The cloth that they had used to prepare his body for burial, he would never need it again. Jesus is not going to die again. So, Jesus' resurrection is a singular event. In some respects, it looks like what happened with other people, but in some ways, it is absolutely distinct. Early believers didn't quite understand this. And that's why Paul had to write 1 Corinthians 15. I understand that it was a letter that was addressed specifically to the Corinthians, but my impression is that these letters would have been read more broadly than just to the Corinthians. And so there was a difficulty in comprehending this. And I can understand that, you know, for the apostles, it was easier to understand because they had seen him. They had touched him. But most people didn't have that experience. So they have to accept the word of somebody else that Jesus is alive. And frankly, everything I know, every fiber of my being argues that that's not the case. I've seen death. I have been there when people died, and people just don't come back from that. This is, you know, everything I know is this is not the case. It really is the case, but I have a hard time grasping that. So one of the reasons that we're going to talk so much about the resurrection is we have to believe this. We have to know that Jesus is raised from the dead. And our resurrection is going to be like Jesus's. It's going to be a bodily reality. We are really going to come out of the grave. Can I get somebody to read Philippians 3, 20 and 21?
So we are set up in heaven where the Lord Jesus Christ lives, and we are eagerly waiting for him to return as our Savior. He will take our weakest mortal bodies and transform them into glorious bodies like he does, using the same power with which he was able to transform them.
Okay. So our bodies will be changed. Jesus' body was changed. The body he had after resurrection was not the body he went into the grave with. So it was changed and will be changed, and it will be like Jesus. Comments, questions. Yeah, Bill.
Yeah, I have a question now. We've been born again. We believe that Jesus died. He's dead as a doornail, and raised from the grave. And if he was dead, there was no electrical activity. He was dead. How did he raise himself unless his spirit had departed and he came back into his body?
Can't answer that question. I think it's important for us to remember that when we think about our own existence, we are not a body that has a spirit. We're a spirit that has a body. Okay. And at death, the body dies. The spirit continues to live. The spirit never ceases. And while we can't conceive of being able to interact with the physical world unless we had a body, that's an improper understanding of the reality of the spirit world. Okay? So even though Jesus didn't at that point have a body, you remember he died, he was in the grave for 3 days, the body is gone. He doesn't have the body that he can use to exert the influence to raise himself from the dead, but his soul does. His spirit does. So that is an imperfect answer to that question. That discussion, we'll talk about that discussion a little bit more as we get into this, but that discussion, we may not understand that completely until it happens to us.
Well, I understand that way, that the spirit was alive, the soul was alive. and it just returned and animated the body.
Yeah, Kim.
So the resurrected body was different than the pre-death body. Even his closest followers, his confidant, his best friend, didn't recognize him at first. Even the women in the at the tomb, Mary, she thought he was a guardian. And saying, what have you done with him? Assuming that his body had been stolen. And then when he spoke, she recognized him. What's always baffled me, though, because I know his resurrected body was different, whatever it was like. I don't know, he's here for what, 50 days, something like that. Whatever that looked like, people eventually recognized him, for however they did. But they didn't always at first. And Thomas, he says, I'm not going to believe it. I'm not going to believe it. Yet he proved it by something physical, by him having the feeling of the hole. How do you have those holes? is that baffles me. Is somehow whatever resurrected body this was, he needed to prove to Thomas, who was doubting, that he was the one in the thing, and when he touched it, he knew.
Yeah.
I have no idea, but I do know that his resurrected body was different, because had it been the same, Thomas probably wouldn't have doubted. He would say, oh, there's my friend. Of course. You know, I don't know.
It's a good point.
But I do know that you know, his spirit animated whatever it was, but it was not his pre-death body.
Right. While the spirit didn't change.
Right.
Okay. The spirit that he had pre-death was the same spirit that he had post-death. The body changed. And, you know, you make it's the same, only different?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's the body.
I just find it really interesting. I think, and my take on it is, because Jesus, being a spirit entirely at this point, recognized that Thomas needed something physical to reassure him. And somehow he was able to do that with his body, with whatever that looked like or was like, and how close to a physical body as we know it is, I have no idea. But somehow there's that physical element. And I think Jesus provided that for Thomas' sake, whatever that was. He needed that physical reassurance, kind of like we were talking about this morning and how limited we are in our class, how limited we are by our humanness. And I think that Jesus, and throughout Scripture, Jesus, what's a good word for it? Honors that all the time. He speaks to us in a way that we can understand, and provides that for us, humbling himself in order to do that. And I think that's what he did with Thomas. He humbled himself so that Thomas could believe.
And thank goodness he does.
Absolutely.
Because there's a lot of what God does that is just so great that I'm not sure we can comprehend it unless he kind of dumbs it down and brings it down to our level, so that we can think about it. You know, even the concept of time, for God, there's no such thing as before and after. So when we get to talking about the resurrection and its association with the judgment, you know, we kind of look at all of these passages and we construct this timeline. This happens, then this happens, then this happens, then this happens. God doesn't think that way. It's not even a part of what God has to contend with. Yeah, Ted?
Again, as we were talking this morning about time, it's very difficult for us to wrap our minds around what the resurrected body would look like, because, again, we fall back into time. If I read the body, then he might need to know about it. Then he might need to know about it. I mean, those are two different bodies. Is it going to
I hope mine is.
And then we fall back into time, we don't understand what this means. Our spiritual form, whatever that's going to be, will be something that we will be recognized by. And it will be something that we will understand when it comes. But until that happens, our linear bodies and minds cannot wrap our minds around. It's not possible.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good point. Yeah, we're very limited, and thank goodness God understands our limitations, and He accommodates those limitations, and He does a lot of things to help us understand, and I think that's important. Okay, let's turn to the second theme. Jesus was resurrected first. We follow later. And our resurrection is like Jesus' resurrection. Can somebody read 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 23?
For each in his own order, Christ the first fruit, after that those who are Christ at his time.
Right. And remember, that contained a time reference in it. After that, those that are Christ at his coming. So, Jesus is raised, and at some point, we're raised. Jesus is the first fruit. And that's really important. I remember... I think it was some time ago, somebody was talking about the Lord's Supper and talked about fruit and sacrifice and how important it was that they sacrificed the very best. This is all bound up in the idea of the first fruit. You normally what we would do is we would keep the best and we would sacrifice something less, because if we're going to try to replicate this, we need the best. If you've got seeds, you keep the best seeds and you eat the ones that aren't so hot. But Jesus is the first fruit. All people are going to follow. Some are changed without the death process. Most are changed somehow in association with the death process. Some few will remain alive when Jesus comes again. And even that concerned some of the early Christians. They said, well, what happens when we're raised, we're changed, and we're not going to die? So do we get to go to heaven? And that we'll talk a little bit about that as we continue. Third theme, the judgment of all men is connected with the return of Jesus and our resurrection. And that's kind of what the article in this week's bulletin was all about. Can somebody read 1 Corinthians 5 at verse 10? I think I wanted 15. I'm sorry. Oops. Yeah, 1 Corinthians 15, 10. Okay. Now, this resurrection and the subsequent judgment is for Christians a great celebration. This is a tremendous outlook. If you don't follow Jesus, this is scary that we're all going to be raised. Now, as we're going through all of this, we're going to focus on the promise for Christians. We understand that judgment involves condemnation for those people that aren't followers of Jesus. We're not going to focus on that. We're going to put our focus on the tremendous blessing that we have. And it's a blessing that we want other people to share. That's why we talk to them about the things of God. We want them to share this blessing. Jesus' resurrection establishes his lordship and hence his divinity. If you go back and you read what Jesus' followers said, not the words that Jesus said to his followers, but the words that the followers said to Jesus or about Jesus, when it comes to the resurrection, their language changes. It's just a clear line of demarcation. Now, Jesus has always talked about himself as Lord. And he always accepted the worship of men as if he was God or as God, okay? But once he's raised from the dead, all of the believers then start talking about him as, well, Thomas says it, my Lord and my God. This is an important change. Not only do you see it in terms of the language that the apostles and the other people that witnessed the resurrected Jesus, not only do you see it in the language that they used, but you also see it in the way that they behaved. What did the disciples do after Jesus was buried?
They were kind of afraid, and then kind of went back to work. They went back to fishing and doing what they did before, and they were kind of confused and not sure what to do.
Yeah. And once they had seen Jesus
back together again,
they never wavered after that point. It's an amazing transformation. And that transformation is what we're trying to capture. I'll just be honest about it. We're trying to become as convicted as the apostles were, so that we can do what the apostles did. Now, understand that, you know, I'm not saying we're ever going to do miracles. We're not going to do what the apostles did in terms of their preaching, but we're going to be like they were in terms of our conviction. Yeah, Bill.
For us that never experienced Jesus in the body, we have faith, hope, and love. But seeing that one raised from the grave in reality is something we can never have. We can have a faith, hope, and love. But I didn't see him rise. If I did, it would have knocked me flat. It's different when you believe it by faith than when you actually see it.
Yeah. Yeah. But it needs to produce the same kind of conviction that it produced in those people. And so that's one of our goals as we go through this. Yeah, Carol.
The conviction that these men had after Jesus' resurrection, that to go through the escapades that happened to them and everything that they endured to the end and did faithfully. And the Christians that they talked to who also went through that, that firsthandness of understanding is really so much greater than the faith that we have because of the fact that they just couldn't doubt it. They absolutely could not doubt what they saw.
Yeah. Kim?
I think about their conviction. Secular history tells us that all but one of the apostles was martyred for this faith. And if you're willing to go to your death an excruciating, horrific death for your faith, you have to have conviction. And so I often, when I think about that, I think, well, I have that kind of conviction. Am I that convicted that I would be willing to be tortured for my faith? And I sure hope so. And I want to have the conviction that they have. And I think I disagree with Bill. I think we see the crucifixion. He was described right here. This is the crucified Jesus. And for Paul, that's what he wrote about the most in talking to early Christians who struggled with that, just like we struggle with it. But he described it so beautifully, just like his mission. And I think that we, when we come to Jesus in faith, we need to see the crucified and resurrected Jesus. We need to have that intimate relationship with him.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we would not be willing to sacrifice like they sacrificed, to have that kind of conviction where we would be willing to be martyred for our faith.
Yeah. I think that's true. Let's talk very quickly about a last theme that we'll be developing as we go through here. The resurrected life is a metaphor for our converted life. Transformation to a converted Christian is as complete as being dead and raised to life. We don't always think about transformation as being that complete. Most of the time, I think when I think about transformation, I think about God grinding down all of the sharp edges that I used to have. And that's not what it is. It's not God just grinding down the sharp edges so that I'm a better person. It's as great a transformation as being dead and coming to life. Now that metaphor draws on the reality of Jesus' death. When I say it's a metaphor, we can never diminish what happened in the resurrection. And I don't want us to think, well, Jesus being raised from the dead is like me being raised from the dead. It's not all that big a deal. That's not the way I want you to think about it. The way I want you to think about it is, it's a big deal that we get transformed. That's Romans 6. And we've been talking about that in the book of Romans. Other questions? We'll close and we'll come back to it. Yeah, Faye.
Thinking out loud,
that
things that they feel that they have to do to live.
That's true.
Because the things that we take away, the things we take away, and then we go to Christian and we've got something new. So we didn't have to do that.
Yeah.
And as long as you see it,
as long as you feed it.
Yep. Right. Right. Okay. There's a lot that we're going to discuss as we talk about the resurrection. Next week, we'll be thinking a little bit about what the Old Testament says about the expectation of life after death. And remember, it's not nearly as clear as the statements that we'll read in the New Testament. So next week, just prepare yourself. We're going to put aside what we know from the New Testament, and we're going to think Old Testament and the way that they would have thought about life after death.